Welcome to the Just Raise podcast. I'm your host, Joe Sweeney. Today on the show, we are talking to a company that's using your data to build a hive mind to take on the stock market and potentially beat even Google. On the front end, Delphia looks like a new trading app, but it's not. It's a way for users to add their data to a giant data aggregate that can then be used to do things like predict whether or not Netflix subscriptions are going up or down, and use that to take on the stock market. It's a pretty wild idea that's backed by crypto and blockchain to make data portable and usable, and it's now backed by $60 million from Multicoin as of last week. It's a wild concept, and I was so glad to have CEO and founder Andrew Peek on the show to talk about it. Maybe the hardest thing for startups to do right now is to hire great developers. They're the most in-demand resource in the world right now, which is why Lemon.io has the answer, with vetted software engineers who can help you build product immediately. So stop burning money and hire devs smarter at Lemon.io. So what exactly does Delphia do? Like, break it down for the audience who maybe hasn't read the white paper yet.
I think starting with a data DAO is a good starting point, quite frankly. You know, you've probably heard that data is valuable. You might believe that your data is valuable. A lot of people do. But in actuality, your data, my data individually is not worth very much. Data is worth a ton in aggregate because it leads to better prediction. And so if you're going to try and help people use their data like an asset, if you're going to try and help them use it like a medium of exchange, then you need a context where you can aggregate people's data together, where everybody benefits as one from that aggregation. And we chose investing, and specifically quantitative investing. And we think it's a massive context with all the right incentives.
So you're allowing people to come on, share everything they're doing on their iPhone with you, for instance, anonymously, and then taking that data in aggregate and using it to tell whether or not Netflix subscriptions are going to go up or down.
That's it. So we make money by predicting surprise with regards to a company's fundamentals. So, you know, Netflix subscribers is a really good example. That might roll into a revenue line item in Netflix's earnings. We're looking for any kind of trend in the data that would give us some indication that the consensus estimates around Netflix's revenue are off. And they might be off due to subscribers. They might be off due to average revenue per user, due to churn. Don't think of it like you're looking for the one specific insight in the data that gives you a thumbs up or thumbs down. You're actually looking for a lot of tiny indicators which either agree or disagree with each other. That you're looking for consensus to emerge amongst these different nonlinear relationships.
Explain to me what exactly the data DAO means, how you will collect data and then use that to essentially arbitrage the market, what everyone else, the quantitative hedge funds, don't know yet, but you do because you have customer data.
Well, a data DAO is as simple as downloading a mobile application, opening an investment account with us, which could be as, you know, small an account as $25, and then really connecting whatever apps on your phone you feel comfortable connecting. And the interesting part that makes us a collective is that other people are doing that exact same exercise. All these different Delphia investors are all piping whatever data they feel comfortable with into a common place. And then we're looking for trends in that data so that we can update our stock selections vis-a-vis our algorithm in order to produce a better return for everybody who's participating. Obviously, you know, all the normal caveats around guaranteed performance and all that, but that's the intention.
How does this fit into the broader market of crypto and quantitative hedge fund? And there are a lot of, I guess, tools for investing these days.
So it's actually, we didn't invent this practice. We just democratized it. So this actually happens on Wall Street today. Most people don't realize this, but hedge funds will buy our data. We're not aware of it. They buy our credit card data, Clickstream data, whatever it might be. And they're using our data to improve their stock selection. And so we figured, well, we can do a better job of that because they might be buying all these different behavioral streams of data independently. But where we have an advantage here is we can link all of those to a common person. because it's informed consent. The individual is contributing their data because they want to improve the stock selection. That is how you outcompete in this space, is you have a better data advantage. You still need a really good framework for ingesting all that data and turning it into stock selections. So you're not excused from like a really good model or a really good breakthrough. But if you have this piece and you can cultivate that data piece, that does make for something pretty exceptional.
So you're like Titan on the front end, a algorithmic hedge fund that I can put my money in and have it grow over time. But on the back end, you're actually collecting data and building tokens to reward users, and then using that to essentially build like a general AI that can predict anything based on what people are doing.
There you go. We get the Titan comparison a lot. I would say the difference is that Titan's putting you in maybe 20 stocks. And the advantage of Titan is that they believe they are great stock pickers, the individuals who are running the show. We're saying we as humans are not great individual stock pickers. We believe that you should have hundreds, if not thousands, of stocks in a portfolio. That diversification is a huge benefit. It means that you don't need to have such an exceptional batting average across every stock. You can afford to be very good or just good across a large breadth. And so that's quantitative investing. It's a little bit of a different beast than discretionary or fundamental investing.
I talked to Clayton on the podcast a while back, the CEO, and I have just been getting hammered over the head with their Subway ads in New York City.
Yeah, they're doing well. Yeah.
It feels like the risk with that model and kind of your hook at the front here, where you're trying to bring people on, is that your algorithm really has to be performant. And how do you kind of hedge that risk for investors? Whereas, you know, there's a really interesting long-term play here, but if, you know, your algorithm drops 50% for some reason, you're going to lose a lot of users very quickly. And it's going to be hard to build a venture-backed business on top of that.
So for retail investors, you can't give them what's called pure alpha, right? You can't just give them a portfolio that's entirely predicated on your prediction skill. The SEC won't allow it. It's sort of regulated out. So really what you're doing is you're taking your skill, which is the active return or the alpha, and you've got to put it on top of a benchmark, which represents the market, right? Some fraction of the market, which is the beta. And so, you know, we're always at some level going to be exposed to movement in the market, right? S&P 500 can go up, it can go down. And in retail space, we're not exempt from that. The goal is that we outperform that benchmark, right? So the skill we're putting on top, which is the active return, you know, we want to beat that benchmark 3 out of 5 days or 3.5 out of 5 days. That's really how you go about it. And so I think the way you keep people in the long run is you just show them the relative performance against the benchmark.
I think my favorite question for founders and in venture capital in general is why now? Why hasn't this been done before? Customer data has existed a long time.
I think attitudes started to change when Cambridge Analytica broke, when that story broke. People realized their data had value. And then we've had so many data breaches since then that we've kind of just come to accept two things. My data has value, or data has value, and it's out there everywhere, and there's no slowing it down. And so if you hold those both as true, then your new sort of goal is to actually get benefit from your data rather than try to bring it all back in. I don't think that excludes the need for privacy and security and things like that, but I do think that attitudes have really shifted around personal data in the last couple of years.
Yeah. We were raised on the idea that anything you put on Facebook can be used against you in a job interview. And now I'm just comfortable with the fact that all of my data is being collected by someone somewhere.
Yeah. Now you're willing to trade off jobs if you need to.
Switching gears a little bit here. You have a fascinating background. I think one of your last jobs was as a managing partner at a boutique hotel chain. And you, prior to that, started and sold the company to Shopify. And somewhere in there, you were a teacher for TEDx speakers. How did you get here to building this company?
I've always just identified as an entrepreneur. And the industry for me is sort of, I'm agnostic to it. It just so happens that technology has the most design space to offer. And so I keep coming back to it. It's fascinating. Now this project, Delphi, I've chosen something that has decades of runway ahead of it. But yeah, no, I've always just prioritized building things from scratch and trying to figure out the puzzle. And I've just made the, you know, I've just pursued different puzzles through time. And Delphia might be the best one I've ever chosen.
What brought you to this idea? Was it prediction markets or crypto?
It was a sense of fairness and an opportunity. I came across a research lab back in 2014. It had spun out of the University of Toronto. And they were helping people use their personal data to make a really big decision in their life, which is going to dovetail with the Cambridge Analytica story. Around the same time as Cambridge Analytica, this lab was helping you calculate your alignment to the different candidates that were running in an election. And so they had a 50-question long-form survey. It was like 10 minutes long. But if you completed it and you answered it honestly, it gave you this incredible representation of your alignment in this beautiful infographic across different issues and everything. And people would then share that on social media. So you could then link behavior to sort of profile. And what this allowed them to do is forecast the election results, the entire distribution, with unprecedented accuracy in dozens of countries. And that's when I kind of woke up to the realization that the game wasn't over. Google and Facebook hadn't necessarily won. There was a whole new dimension of data, which is these like layered profile attributes and the joining of behavior. But the only way to get it is to do it honestly and authentically. You have to have alignment with the individual. They have to be motivated to self-declare. And so that was a fascinating realization for me. And then at that point, you know, the rest was about discovering how far we could take it.
So Facebook has a lot of data, but only on Facebook. Google has everything you do on Chrome and a few other places.
I would say they have a lot of behavioral data in general, right? You can't win on surface area. They've got a lot of surface area coverage. What they don't have is you going into Facebook on a daily, answering questions about yourself and the world around you and how you see things. You don't have that relationship to Facebook where you're just piping these attributes at them in a very honest kind of way, a reliable kind of way.
Yeah, this might be an obvious question, but why start with the stock market with all of this data?
Well, so if you tell people you want to turn their data into an asset or an asset class, it's a very esoteric thing to say. People say, that sounds fantastic. What does it mean? And so you need to drop it into a context, right? It's kind of like if you're Tesla, and you know, you're really an energy company or a battery company, you're going to need a first use case for those batteries that is massive, because it's going to sustain you and keep you alive long enough to see a future when those batteries are ubiquitous, right? And so they vertically integrated the automobile business. Similarly, if you're going to be a data platform, well, you have to vertically integrate that first use case. And investing is, like I said, huge. And so it has this significant amount of capacity, which is great for bootstrapping this data set. But number two, it's got the right incentives, right? Investing, you make money from correctly guessing whether someone's going to buy Coke or buy Pepsi. You don't need to influence them to buy Coke or Pepsi, which is how advertising works.
How much data do you need for this to work? Like 10,000 users, 100,000 users, 20 million users, all in the same 20-mile radius. What's kind of the critical mass you need for real predictions to start working?
You need a representation of the population, but not quite an even representation. You can do some techniques called post-stratification and all that. But we have milestones internally. So at 250,000 people contributing data, we will begin looking for new discoveries. We'll begin researching on that data for more alpha. At around 500,000, we expect to find more alpha. And around 1 million to 2 million people, we expect to hit an escape velocity. You really can't buy a data set in the alternative data market today if you're a hedge fund that is, you know, after you've cleaned it out, that is more than 2 or 3 million people.
I think that's a really good segue into the algorithms you're building themselves. What's interesting about it is you're not trying to predict whether or not stocks will go up and down based on the latest earnings call, or like you're not doing the quantitative hedge fund style where you're trying to predict what other people will do and then react to that. You're fundamentally trying to predict whether or not Netflix subscriptions go up or down, or how much time people are using on Facebook. How does that algorithm work, and how does that feed into kind of the business model components of these big companies that analysts are looking at every day?
it's a bit of a hybrid, right? So it's taking a fundamental investor like Titan. It's like taking their mindset, right? They have a belief around what KPIs, what fundamentals matter to a sector or to a company or a group of companies, and saying, okay, well, how do we do that at scale? How do we bring a quant toolkit to bear on doing that, not just for 20 stocks, right? But for the entire Russell 3000. How do we make predictions on the daily for that entire cross section? It's causal, right? Most quants, like you said, are reacting. They're seeing information change, and they're high frequency, low latency, and they're just trying to react and catch the correction. That's not how we're playing. We're playing using quantitative toolkit to predict and prognosticate ahead. And so we call it causal forecasting internally, but we think that is a whole leap forward in the way quant investing is done. And so pretty significant breakthrough in our opinion.
So it's fundamental investing, but I guess like all investing, you're still trying to arbitrage information that the rest of the market hasn't seen yet.
Exactly, right? So the market, right, all the analysts, the large cohorts of actors in the market have a belief around what Netflix's sales are going to be, you know, at earnings. And probably not just in the immediate quarter, but maybe in a couple of quarters ahead. And if we have a different belief, if we think there's a surprise coming, then we'll take a position in Netflix and we'll wait for that to converge, right? We'll harvest during that convergence and then we'll exit the position.
Yeah, it's a wild idea.
It's a little different.
So, I mean, what you'll be able to do with that, where do you see this going beyond, I mean, the markets are a big thing to solve, but maybe after that, where do you see the company expanding into? What else could this be used for?
Well, so as I mentioned at the outset, data in aggregate leads to better prediction. So if you're building a data DAO, the goal is to be able to attract any third party, anyone out there who has a suspicion they could do better prediction if they had access to the DAO's data. If we truly create a platform here, then somebody should theoretically be able to show up. It could be two people in a garage who want to build the next search engine, who have a belief that if they trained their model on our data, they could do better than Google, for example. And in that world, we wouldn't want to charge them. We wouldn't want to say, well, what's your training budget? They'd say, well, we're a startup. We have no training budget, right? So what we want instead is we'd want to take some allocation in whatever they're building. And so we'd put their offer in front of this DAO. Some would say yes to it. Some would say no. And then the subset that throws their hand up and says, yeah, I'm into that. I'd give my data for that. Well, great. You're now going to have some skin in whatever they're building. That's where this goes in the fullness of time.
Wow. So you're building equity for everyone in the next giant tech startup via DAO that they have access ownership in, that then has ownership of the next Google.
You could put it that way for sure. Yeah, so we're thinking about it.
Lemon.io is an awesome new developer recruiting tool that makes it easier than ever to hire great talent. Every software company needs killer developers, but hiring technical talent is hard and the costs of getting it wrong are huge. Lemon.io has handpicked developers that can start in less than 48 hours. And if you check it out today, fans of Just Raise get 15% off for the first 4 weeks of work. Check it out at lemon.io. So how do you think about tokens? And that's where the crypto piece comes in and is, I think, one of the more practical use cases of crypto. It's crypto beyond crypto's sake, which is always interesting, I think. How is the DAO engineered and how are you thinking about tokens?
Right now, I would call the DAO emerging, right? We have a collective of people contributing data and we're going to be wrapping them in a DAO structure over the months to come. We've been following the space and there's a lot of pioneers who are out ahead of us and in doing things that are totally permissionless or decentralized or what have you. There's a lot of operating risk as well in pioneering on every frontier. And so we're quite content to sort of let others trudge forward and take some best practices. But governance is a big thing we're looking to solve this summer. So how is the DAO governed? We also think about subtokens quite a bit. So within the data set, you've got people contributing, you know, Robinhood data or Venmo data or credit card data. And each of these is probably not going to be as valuable to an overall meta model, right? And so you have an interesting opportunity there to sort of create a network of sub-tokens as well. So these are the kinds of things we think about.
One of the most, I guess, counterintuitive ideas is that people have always been worried, or there have always been headlines about companies stealing your data or using your data for nefarious things. And you're essentially saying, we are going to use your data, but we're going to pay you for it. So tell us every single thing you do on Venmo, every single thing you do across your entire phone, all of these platforms. I'm sure there are a lot of people who would be very willing to do that for the opportunity to be part of a much bigger organization that has ownership in future companies.
So we're betting the same thing, right? And people will draw the line differently. So there's things that I may not be willing to share. And then ultimately, you want to get to a place where it's easy for me to take that data with me one day if I want to leave, if I don't like the rules of the game anymore. And so we do believe in a portable data future as well, which, you know, I think Congress has shown that they also believe in that. And so we're seeing regulation to that effect. And that's all positive. That's net positive. But yeah, I think we will be surprised. It's a bit of a narrative violation, but I think we'll be surprised at people's willingness.
Yeah, it's very counterintuitive. It's like the exact opposite of what everyone else has been trying to do, talking about how much they protect your data, or at least don't use your data.
And there's ways to get to that point too, right? And so we keep track of things like federated machine learning, and obviously we want to involve, you know, a secure training environment and multi-party computation in this mix, but a startup dies from indigestion, not from starvation. And so you have to pursue these projects at the right moment.
Has the idea of a data DAO existed for a long time?
I don't know that it has. I think maybe you started to see whispers of it in the last year or two. Tushar from Multicoin had a really strong thesis around data DAOs, which is what brought us together. We tend to fit perfectly into that thesis. But no, I think it's a fairly new concept. I mean, you could maybe find a prior in like a Web2 space and that wouldn't have been called a data DAO, but maybe a data network or something like that. But
so diving into the mechanics a little bit, you have 6 PhDs on staff building, I imagine, everything from the data analytics to the quantitative hedge fund, really. How did you bring those people on? What was your pitch to them? How were you able to attract such talent from hedge funds and Wall Street and from talented AI engineers?
So people have a lot of choice these days. They can work on whatever they want. I think of like compensation as a baseline. You've got to meet people's compensation expectations, but that's not how you attract really intelligent people. You have to give them a really hard to reach mission, and you've got to make sure that they love working with the people around them, right? Because most of it's about the journey. If you put a mission on the table that's decades into the future, or, you know, years into the future, then you can't make it about the destination. It's too far. That's a great North Star and it'll get you out of bed in the morning. But you also need to really enjoy the people you're collaborating with on the road to getting there. And what has attracted people to Delphia is the mission's very ambitious, but it's theoretically possible. And the kind of person who comes to Delphia is somebody who goes, I know that's theoretically possible. I will gladly inch my way towards that thing over time. And I enjoy working with the people around me.
One of the last things we always do on the show is a lightning round.
Oh, great.
The first question, and one of the best, is what's top of mind for you right now? Like, what has to go right over the next 3 months for Delphia to really take off?
I think we've got to get the governance correct on the DAO. You know, I think we have to roll out the token in a thoughtful way, where people really understand how to use it, what it's about. Those are two critical things. You know, we're a little at the mercy of the market. So you hit on that. There is some effect to when you have a recession or a crash or what have you. We're not completely insulated from that, though the goal is to put performance on top of that. I think that's probably it. We just got to keep shipping, right? Just keep moving forward.
If you were starting from scratch tomorrow, and I know you did start pretty recently, but if you were starting from scratch, what's one thing you would do differently?
You know, we made a decision in 2017 when we were still a research lab. We were going to either build from the crypto primitives up, or we were going to start centralized and decentralized through time. And we made that decision in a mutually exclusive kind of way. So we chose centralized first and decentralized over time. And then about 18 months ago, started to work on our token economics. I think I would have bifurcated the effort a little bit more. I think I would have run both processes in parallel a little bit more. It's always tough to say that because you're very resource constrained as a startup. But you know, we're building out the crypto DNA of the company right now. And instead of maybe 20% of our team, I wish it was, you know, 60% of our team.
Caught the crypto wave that came, and I don't want to say
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That would have been the downside, right? You would have had the business would have been exposed to the highs and the lows, right?
Yeah. The token, you talked a little bit about it, but I'm really interested in the idea of giving out tokens to early product users. I've talked to a couple crypto-based games companies that talk about issuing tokens that will be used for one game and then potentially all of their games. And you think about some of the game studios, like people who made Assassin's Creed. I played the first Assassin's Creed, and now they're one of the most valuable companies or gaming companies out there. And same thing if you had tokens for early users of Instagram before it got acquired by Facebook or really any tech company.
Yeah.
How do you think about tokens kind of accruing value over time and how to insulate customers from that?
The thing about investing is some of the best strategies out there have properties to them that make them scarce, right? There's a capacity limit usually to like an investment strategy, or there's some sort of information asymmetry to maybe the predictions that underpin it or the insights that underpin it, right? And so we think about the accrual of token as something that unlocks access to different strategies that are coming, different insights and predictions that are coming. It's effectively, you know, markets are, at least alpha is generally predicated on some kind of information asymmetry. And so we want to reward those who have really been our best contributors with access to information that might be synonymous with what Wall Street gets today.
Yeah. It's a really interesting idea. And as these companies scale, I feel like that will be a core mechanic of product over time.
Yeah.
Or could be. We'll see.
Yeah.
Beyond what you're building, what do you think is one really interesting business that people will be talking about in 18 months, couple of years?
It's not new per se, but I keep a fascinated eye on Numerai, right? So Numerai is it's sort of like Delphi and Numerai are like kissing cousins in a way, right? Numerai has chosen to sort of crowdsource the data science, and then they roll everything into a meta model. We've chosen to kind of crowdsource the data. And so I'm fascinated by I love hive mind type projects. And I'm always fascinated by whether you can just coordinate a large group of people towards a particular outcome. And the way they've gone about it is interesting. I think there's theoretical constraint on it, but maybe I'm wrong. It's something that I'm actually just sort of open to continuing to follow and learning from. So I think also Richard is a fascinating guy.
Are there any tactics for coordinating large groups of people in that kind of almost decentralized way that you think are interesting that people could learn from?
There are, but I think most importantly, actually, and this is where Tushar and I from Multicoin agree, is don't put too much pressure on the coordination, right? If you are expecting a large group of people to really like drive all of the enterprise value, it's a tall order, right? Because coordination is a really hard set of activities. You want the baseline coordination to be very simple. And just like in Delphi, it's, you know, do I want to connect my Twitter or not? You know, Venmo or not, right? Let's just start there. Can I answer a question that's coming through the app or not, right? And then beyond that, you'll have people who want to coordinate at, you know, increasingly higher levels of fidelity, like prediction markets or whatnot. And so just like, you know, the old adage about the number of people who comment on YouTube or make videos and then comment and then watch is sort of different orders of magnitude, I think you need to treat coordination in a similar vein.
I've run into prediction markets a few times before. I once met a founder who's building a company for predicting disease states. And he found that there were a few random people in Pakistan and a couple other places that had like 99% hit rates on whether or not a certain patient with a specific medical record and diagnostic tests had cancer or whatever other disease. And it's a wild, wild idea that you just source predictions from everyone and then look at their accuracy and essentially grade them on different skill sets. Can you walk through like what a prediction market is though, and maybe the history of them?
So Joey Krug from Augur, I think, is probably my best informant on this topic. But prediction markets are generally trying to show what the consensus of a number of actors looks like, right? So if you have an event, let's just say an election, everybody's got their own pocket of information they're working with that is informing their belief about who's going to win or what the odds are. And a prediction market is essentially a reflection of the aggregate odds of everybody's beliefs. And the bet you're making is that it's going to attract people, to your point about from a minute ago, it's going to attract the kind of people who have a really good pocket of information. You're going to get enough of them that their expression is going to tilt that scale, right? So they might have very strong, like 99% conviction that one candidate is going to win. And it's predicated on some really good information that you don't know at the time, but is expressed in their bet. And that'll pull the average of the entire population that's participating, you know, from 51 to 60%, let's just say, likelihood. I don't think you get there. I don't think prediction markets function just off taking in everybody's uninformed opinion and averaging it out, right? I think it has to attract the kind of people who are going to have a special way of looking at a problem or a special amount of information and are therefore going to have strong conviction that pulls that average.
Because otherwise it's just polling, right? Like asking people, who do you think is going to win, and averaging that out.
Exactly, right? Like there's no alpha in taking the average. So just take stocks again, right? If we said, you know, what should be in the portfolio? Should we buy or should we sell? And we just asked everybody, and everybody was sort of just coming at it from their own personal vantage point with like no real special information. That by definition is consensus, right? So if price already reflects consensus, then there's no money to be made. And so you have to be able to bring something to bear that is different than consensus.
And that's the whole concept of Delphia, is that you are going to use this massive data set and all of these different users who are bought into the platform who want Delphia to succeed to be both non-consensus and right, or find things that are non-consensus and bet on those because you know they're right based on user activity.
Yeah. As we get further and further ahead, that is more and more true, right? So for example, if you have people sort of speculating, what's more valuable? Is my Robinhood trade data more valuable or is my Venmo transaction data more valuable? Well, we have a way that we can test that. And then we have a way to reward those who guessed correctly.
Yeah, that's wild. Well, this has been fascinating. My last question for everybody on the show is about vision. Mm. Where would you like to see Delphia, if everything goes well, in 10 or even 20 years?
I'd like to see this data set in the hands of the DAO, right? I'd like to see them really driving how this data set gets used. I'd like to see data be a truly sort of portable asset. And I'd like to see us have internalized that it is the medium of exchange of the internet, right? And ideally, we're not working necessarily with cash as much anymore because the internet just wants more data. And we've got a fantastic wrapper, you know, to put around that data or different vectors of that data, which we can then use across the web in different ways.
You mentioned fairness earlier, and I imagine that's part of where you think fairness can be achieved.
It is. So again, the company's mission is to expand access to financial prosperity. And the truth is we're not going to get there with our labor. You need capital.
Yeah.
Right. And it's just because the return on capital is, as Piketty said, different than the return on labor. And so the only way that we're going to get anywhere close to making a sort of a dent in that wealth gap or even being alive to see the apex of it is if we can find people some capital. And we have this belief that there's this latent asset in their back pocket right now that just needs to be activated called data. And so I'd love to be around when, you know, maybe we haven't closed it, but maybe we've sort of hit the limit of the wealth divide and we're starting to bend back the other way.
Yeah, that's an awesome vision. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to seeing where this goes and what you build next.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much for having me.